Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
9:10 on a Friday morning. Of course, we are remembering Katrina, but part of the story of the recovery of Katrina is restaurants and bars coming back. And on Friday mornings, we normally talk to Ian McNulty. And look who's sitting right next to me, but Mrs. McNulty's favorite son, Ian. How you doing, Ian?
In the flesh, Tommy. Great to be with
you. Do you have brothers or not?
I got a younger brother, Colin McNulty.
Colin, I'm sorry. I didn't know that when I said favorite son. And look.
No, it's true. It's true.
Is it really?
Yeah, it really is.
Okay,
yeah.
Colin, live with it. I don't know what else to tell you.
Yeah.
Tell me your Katrina story, young man.
Well, you know, Tommy, as we've been reflecting on these things, I've really fixed my mind on the uplift, on the things that we saw and experienced in the weeks, in the months after the storm. And actually, this was the topic of a book I wrote, a memoir called Season of Night. Came out a few years after the storm, but it was really about the experience of New Orleans coming back and these individual neighborhoods. In fact, very focused on my neighborhood of Mid-City and what it was like to live here and just live in it and watch everything come back and be part of it. And the restaurant scene, the hospitality scene, Tommy, they were in it from day one. I mean, truly, you know, we could talk about like when FEMA got here or whatever. The restaurant scene actually never stopped. From the earliest days, people who were in the business of feeding people switched into emergency mode and started making red beans, emptying their freezers,
Well, I was going to say that brings me to our mutual friend, Ralph Brennan, right?
Mm.
And what he did with Redfish Grill and serving food out of paper cups.
I've heard a lot of stories that have been reminded of me to me in the last few days about, oh, this was open, that was open. Yeah, some places for, you know, Laurel Street Bakery way uptown was serving coffee a couple days afterwards. You know, this is before even the gravity of it all had sunk in. Slim Goodies was slinging plates of food. But Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill was definitely the first restaurant to be open with a health permit, right? And so they found themselves with no electricity, no gas, no potable water, but a wood-burning grill.
Mm-hmm.
And they started getting some fish out and some hamburgers and paper plates and bottled water and fine wine.
Cellar. He told stories of Dom Perignon in paper cups, I think, right? Or styrofoam cups.
Yeah, and that was the spirit of the day. But, Tommy, it was remarkable how fast that shifted from you know, Paul Prudhomme cooking red beans on the sidewalk of Charter Street for first responders, and Redfish Grill trying to find a way to get their wood burning grill lit, to Magazine Street giving you options. I remember like Theo's Pizza, Magazine Street. You could get a pizza.
Give me a timeline on this.
This is early days. This is late September, early October. You know, we're talking weeks out.
And what I think people need to realize is that a restaurant is a small business, and at that time, nobody knew what was coming back or what was not coming back, so this was a giant leap of faith on their part, right?
None of these places came back without grinding effort. And that's the thing about the Katrina experience, right, that I think people might not understand if they put it in context of more contemporary disasters. Mm-hmm. You know, we're used to seeing a hurricane, a tornado, something strike, and then people say, oh, well, when are the restaurants coming back? Isn't that a great expression of faith that they reopen that Waffle House? I mean, there's a whole metric tracking Waffle House returns, you know, that sort of thing. But for Katrina, it was the existential question of whether New Orleans would be a city again.
And this we didn't know.
This is not a joke.
No, it's not a joke.
Yeah.
For those that, you know, I got people listening right now probably were 4 or 5 years old when Katrina
right.
hit.
Yeah.
But y'all, Ian's nailing it. We didn't know if the city was coming back, if anybody had jobs. Nobody had any idea of anything.
Yeah, this wasn't like a hunker down and then you can come back out and start rebuilding. Very few people were left in the city.
That's a great point. It was a
biblical exodus of people from the city. And so everyone had to make an individual decision whether they were going to come back, when, and how. That goes for the hospitality community, the restaurants and bars, and it goes for individual households. And very often, when you came back to look, to see what it was like, one of the first things you saw that was some sense of normal or some sense of the old times was a restaurant or a bar. And that really did make a difference for people because they saw a piece of the old life that they could grasp onto and think, maybe I can do this.
And I was going to ask you that because it seems to me that it makes you think, well, if they're here, then the city will come back. Somebody's got to go first, and they went first.
Precisely. Now, in my situation, I was 31 years old at the time, wore a younger man's clothes, wasn't married. All I had was a Labrador Retriever and a job covering restaurants in New Orleans suddenly.
Were you happier then?
It was a time.
That's a yes to the jury, by the way. Yes, he was happy.
My home in Mid-City was flooded. It would not have electricity until early spring, late winter 2006.
You're renting or buying?
Sorry?
You're renting or buying?
I owned it. Yeah, I owned the house.
Oh, boy. All right.
Did
you have flood insurance?
I did, yes. Okay. Thank goodness. Well, the house had never flooded in the 100 years that it had been around until Katrina and the levee failure, more specifically.
Yes, exactly.
But so here I am living. Just what you said, you know, if somebody has to come back first, I was in a very sort of bulletproof feeling time of my life. I can come back. I don't have kids that have to worry about school. I have a job. If I can't come back, no one else can. So I made a decision to camp out in my Mid-City home
really?
For months on end. Yes. Go downtown to plug in the laptop, get electricity.
You live from when until when with no power in Mid-City?
I evacuated before the storm, like right before the storm, because I'd never done that before.
But that's the best time to do it because you miss the traffic.
That's true. Yeah, and I had a 71 Cadillac at that point, which I'm not going to make it in
bumper-to-bumper
traffic.
I bet you wish you had that car now, don't you? 71 Caddy?
It was pretty good.
Fleetwood,
grand,
or what was it? Or
It was a Sedan DeVille.
Oh.
I dubbed it the SS Consumption because it could pass everything but a gas station.
I hope it was white with red upholstery. That's all I ever wanted.
White with blue interior.
There you go.
I'll send you a picture later. Anyway, so there I was living in the city, and you know, but I could make it work. I could string it together. I evacuated. I came back in October 2005. And I stayed, you know, throughout, and then, you know, watched as I was a budding food writer at the time, Tommy. I was in journalism in general before that. I was working for Hibernia Bank. Remember Hibernia Bank? It's now all the Capital Ones, you see.
Wait, you're working in a bank?
It was, yeah. I was
a teller?
No, I was a communications guy,
okay.
Kind of speech writer for the executives,
okay.
That kind of thing. And they wanted to keep me close because they were, you know, ceremoniously reopening. And so they said, hey, you can stay here in Baton Rouge or you can come down to New Orleans and kind of make a go of it because mm-hmm. we're sending a couple executives back to the old tower, the old headquarters, to keep it running.
Do they call it the tower?
They do, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'd rather be in New Orleans. That's where the story was. At the same time, I started writing for Gambit Weekly. Mm-hmm. This is my first big break as a food writer. I'd written for Offbeat before that for a little bit. But here I was with a weekly column covering the New Orleans food scene when it was reconstituting itself place by place.
So you grew with it.
Yes, as a young writer, this was the finishing school.
Mm-hmm.
I got to see that it wasn't just about where to eat or what's cool or what's trendy. It was about these deep connections that people felt to their restaurants, to their restaurant community, to the people behind them, to the families. You learned all this in fire hose fashion. And as things started to come back through Katrina, it was really documenting that and learning what it meant to people and seeing it and feeling it, too, because I was living in it. And, you know, when I left this house, this blackened-out house in an empty neighborhood, I went into the arms of hospitality of these restaurants that were open, and I felt it myself, how good it felt to be in these places, to be surrounded by other New Orleans people, all the other people who wouldn't look at you like a lunatic when you just started bursting out sobbing and then were laughing and toasting and cheersing people the next moment, because that's how we all felt. And that's what these dining rooms and bar rooms were like. It was just, you know, hard on your sleeve, New Orleans, white knuckle grip, don't give up on this culture kind of a feeling. And the restaurants and bars were really hubs of that. And so to document them, to watch them go back and come back and to live it myself, I mean, that sealed it. That sealed the deal.
Yeah, but you had to have an interest in food before this. I mean, you had to have been
sure.
A bit of a gourmand.
Yeah, well, I was...
I don't know what that word means, but yeah, it sounds good.
The Saints made me a football fan, believe it or not.
Really?
Yep, and New Orleans made me a foodie. You know, I had a caloric interest in food before coming down here, for sure. But it really was adopting New Orleans as my home and learning how important food was and deciding I wanted to get to the bottom of it and having some really crappy meals, by the way, in the beginning before I knew where to go mm-hmm. and deciding, well, that can't be the legend of New Orleans.
But that's part of it too, right? I mean, you got to know what not to eat too.
Yeah, right, so you need to find it. But I'm telling you, that Katrina experience really set it. It was... And this went on for years. You go from Redfish Grill in September 2005.
You know, let me take a break, and you can pick it up there when
sure.
we come back. Because I would love to go through the chronology of that. With you mentioned the late Paul Prudhomme cooking red beans on the sidewalk and helping first responders, and Ralph Brennan opening with a permit. We'll go from there and take it through up until today, as a matter of fact.
Here
right?
for it.
One thing I do have to ask you, though, I see you once a year at the Crawfish Cook-Off at, Immaculate Conception in the West Bank,
I think? That's right, yeah.
How do you manage to maintain your weight with all the eating that you do? Because you look like you're in great shape. How do you do this?
No one likes to hear it in this age of shots and everything else, but Tommy, it's iron discipline. It's just what it is. I go out and eat at restaurants. When I'm not at a restaurant, I eat very healthy and exercise.
Wow.
You just have to take off more calories than you put in.
You would think that Ian McNulty would be about 500 pounds. You would think, from all of the eating that he does and writes about, that he himself could have blocked flood walls at 17th Street Canal.
There
he could have just dropped Ian McNulty in, but
there,
no, he looks great.
There was a time when I could plug a gap, that's for sure.
Is that right?
Feeling healthy is a lot better.
He looks great. All right, we'll take a break, pick it up here, we'll come back. Important conversation as we talk about the role of restaurants in the recovery of New Orleans after Katrina. We are live at the Presbyterian Jackson Square, presented by Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungester and Louisiana State Museums, looking back at Katrina. Celebrate New Orleans, America's favorite city. Stick around, more to come with Ian McNulty and me, Tommy Tucker, here on WWL. Tucker, WWL, we're live here at the Presbyterian as we continue to commemorate the 20th anniversary of Katrina. Newell's coming up next with Dave Cohen, and they have a big exhibit that they've opened here at the Presbyterian in Jackson Square. It's presented by Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungester and Louisiana State Museums. Right now we're visiting with Ian McNulty, as we always do. So I asked you before, Ian, the break, to kind of take us chronologically from Ralph Brennan and Dom Perignon in a paper cup, which, as I told him, is still pretty good.
Yeah.
I've had it.
It's good drinking fast. That's all. Huh? Just drink it fast.
It's pretty good. So take me from that point and give me some stops along the way of how we got from there to here with the restaurant and bar and so forth.
Listen, here's the thing. New Orleans, all we do is talk about food, right? You and I get together on a Friday. We talk about food. I go out anywhere. I mean, the dentist, the insurance office, the bank, people talk about food. It's the constant conversation. And even Katrina, for all the calamity, it didn't stop it. People were immediately interested in, like, can the restaurants come back? How can we cook? How can we get some of this food? If I'm displaced, if I'm in Baton Rouge or Houston or God knows where else, can I cook New Orleans food? Can I get Leidenheimer bread? Can I get andouille sausage? And then people started coming back. The MRE era, right? When really, like, the military rations were being handed
forgotten
out.
All about
this
those.
This is what people were eating. Thank God that they had little tiny bottles of Tabasco sauce in them. I mean, this wasn't a Louisiana thing. This is distributed around
they
the world
did.
For
I
the
forgot
military
about that.
Back then, right? But people were talking about, okay, you know, talk to the soldiers. We're going to figure out a way to creolize this chicken tetrazzini, mm-hmm. or make the brownie a little better, or cook these at the same time. I mean, this was really happening in New Orleans. They didn't stop talking about food and thinking about food because it's...
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense, while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.
Part of our culture. And so when the restaurants and bars started coming back in this ad hoc Wild West kind of fashion, yeah, it was cooking red beans on the sidewalk for the first responders, for the neighbors, for the people, just anybody. Can I feed you? What can I do? Can we go through this, use this resource while we have it? We need some semblance of a business, so let's try to do that. And you nailed it earlier. You said restaurateurs, the people coming back and doing this, they were acting on faith because the city was empty. People were, people in positions of power were saying, like, maybe we shouldn't even rebuild. And you had individually, there was no plan. There was no roadmap. I mean, all these plans and committees and stuff would take shape months later and maybe start trickling out some ideas. But it was really in the beginning up to individuals, household by household, business by business. Are you coming back? And the ones that did were making a stand, and it was a gutsy one. They were putting a lot on the line to make this happen. But at the time, action felt good. Doing things felt good. This is what I can control. This realm, this dining room, this kitchen, this small four-item menu. Okay, we're expanding it. Okay, I heard from this supplier. He's actually back in business. I heard from my fisherman. I can't believe it. He's going out fishing. This is the way it developed. Day by day, week by week, so that from those harrowing first days of champagne and paper cups, mm-hmm. You move into October. It's starting to get a little cool in the air. Some more people are filtering back. There's more electricity in the sliver by the river.
City's been
uptown.
Drained.
Yeah, city's been drained, right. Coming back into New Orleans to visit and check on things. My first visit was September 11th, 2005, a very memorable day because of horrible things that happened on that day, but also that was the first day that the Saints played post-Katrina on the road, mm-hmm. Carolina, and we determined we were going to be in New Orleans for that game.
One-night game, by the way, Deuce McAllister, 2 touchdowns, scored the first one.
There you go. I think they won it on a 2-point conversion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we listened to it on the radio broadcast at Molly's at the Market, the bar in Decatur Street. And from there, journeyed forth into the city to explore, check on things, went to my house, which was then still underwater, arrived in it via canoe.
Wait, the first thing you did... Wait a minute.
Yeah.
So priorities. You come in after the hurricane, the first thing you do is go to Molly's at the Market for a couple of drinks and listen to the Saints game. That's what I'm hearing?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
We came down with a nice chest full
then
of supplies.
Then you looked at your home.
Yes, gave the supplies to
get
Molly's
your priorities
at the
straight.
Yes, gave them a bunch of beer, bought the beer back from them at the bar, because that's what you do, and then listened to the games, which would be good, and then went off to New Orleans. Much of New Orleans was still flooded at the time, including my house in Mid-City, found a canoe that was abandoned on Bayou St. John on the levee there.
Are you
the
kidding
natural
me?
High ground. No.
This is a true story?
This is all documented in my book, Season of Night. Check it out. It's still available. Trudged through the streets of Mid-City about a mile or so to my house, pulled up to my front porch as if it was a pier at a dock, and went into my house, grabbed a few things, threw them in a duffel bag. I mean, there's helicopters overhead, airboats going by. This is 2 weeks after the storm. But, Tommy, to your point, next time I came back.
But wait, hang a second.
City was
you're making light of this, and you're a cheerful guy by nature. But at some point, when you first saw your house, what were you thinking? Or were you full of hurricanes? Ironically.
No. My mind was filled with images of being crushed, of it having collapsed, of having it just not even be there somehow, mm-hmm. because that's how bad we thought it was. When I saw this big, sturdy, made of cypress, 100-year-old mm-hmm. shotgun camelback still standing, tattered though it may be,
and flooded.
Oh yeah,
how much water?
Three, past 4 feet. Baseboards. Yeah, it's a raised house, like all the houses in New Orleans of that era, raised because it floods. You just didn't expect.
You know, I saw
a
picture. I saw a picture at I think it was NOLA.com 2 years ago of a flooded neighborhood, and every house was flooded except for the one that was raised, which makes you think, well, that's why they built them that way in the first place, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah. So to your question, my response to that was relief. Okay. There's something to build back on here. Mm-hmm. This is where I left all my stuff. I mean, it's going to be a long road, but it's possible.
I think that's kind of a metaphor, or at least a shared experience for the city in general, because it's like, well, okay, it's terrible, but at least there's something to build upon.
It still is New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Like all this wonderful architecture, this neighborhood fabric, it's still there. We got to clean it. We got to scrub all the threads, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. And we got to do some stitching again, but it's there for us to do. And to bring it back to our theme, the restaurants and bars were a huge part of making that possible, because not just the practical aspect of getting off of MREs and getting back into restaurants mm-hmm. and getting a pizza at Theo's or going to Le Petit Grocery and having like fine contemporary Creole cuisine like a month and change after the storm. But actually,
they were open that soon?
They were. But actually having that encouragement, that heart-filling encouragement that like, yes, parts of my New Orleans, parts of our community are coming back slowly, painfully, and with great grinding effort, but they are. And so to get back to our timeline, you know, you go, you visit the city when it's still flooded and it's surreal. And then you decide to move back and like, okay, I'm going to make a stand. And you figure out a way to do that, whether you're camping in your house or you're staying with somebody else in a part of town that still has electricity, or whatever decision you made or whatever avenue you could make if your job allowed you, if your school situation allowed you, whatever it was. And then you started to kind of make a life again, and it was more of that fabric coming back every time you saw a restaurant coming back again. You know, it wasn't long before the neutral grounds and the corners were blossoming with the yard signs, you know, that usually the politicos use. Mm-hmm. This time it was Herb Saint's coming back, Bayonne is coming back, you know, just in not necessarily in that order, but just every time you drove around town, you saw these heartrending scenes of, you know, reefs of debris everywhere. It just, our life was trudging through all of this, the remainders of the storm, and all the paperwork and all the troubles and all everyone seemingly trying to hold us back. I mean, it really was an us versus them kind of feeling of the world trying to claw New Orleans down while we were trying to climb back up. But then you saw your neighbors and your friends and people you knew from your community doing things, opening those restaurants, getting the bar going again, even if there wasn't electricity. I mean, Tommy, the first time I went to Bank Street Bar in Mid-City, there were no windows. The bar had been moved to the pool table so it could be closer to the missing windows to catch a little breeze. It was all candlelight. and bar service was an ice chest filled with random beers that was unseen out of the glow of the candles, where you kind of put some money on the pool table and the lady would reach down and grab you whatever lukewarm beer and you were happy to have it. And you just thought, I really hope this didn't go through the flood. It probably didn't. Yeah. It probably came from a wall.
I hope you wiped out the rim anyway, just to make sure, right?
Yeah, the little bottle cap keeps the beer in. It must keep the water out. So, you know,
That's an amazing story, though. But let me ask you this. You're a person that is, has emotions, and here's what I'm trying to get to in my own clumsy way. Of all the senses, when you came back and saw the city, was it smell? Was it sight? What is the thing that really just comes back to your mind?
Sound. And sound, the lack thereof, right? Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it could be the lack of the tree canopy, right, with a lot more sunlight than you would have seen normally. Could have been the smell, but you're saying the sound.
It was the emptiness, yeah. In parts of the city, like where I was living in Mid-City at the time, you know, this walk that I took, I walked from my house to Bank Street Bar. It was about a half a mile. I didn't see, this was at night, I didn't see a single person, not a light in any window.
Give me a time frame on this. This is
November 2005. Okay. Not the sweep of headlights from a mile away, and you could see for miles because there was nothing to see. It was this overwhelming sense of emptiness, as if the humanity of the city had evaporated. But then you would walk into a room, even lit by candles, and you would have tangible face-to-face confirmation that other people were crazy enough to come back, and that a little bit of community was rekindling itself around these hubs. And then if you went uptown, if you went to the French Quarter, if you went back to Molly's, if you went to Lillette Restaurant, you would see places that felt like this is sort of normal. I mean, Lillette Restaurant, by October 2005, Chef John Harris was running seasonal specials. I remember a gnocchi with brown butter and sage from October 2005. I mean, that's how
handmade.
That's how determined they were, and that's how that was the real bizarre dichotomy of it all. You mentioned Ralph's in the Park, Ralph Brennan's restaurant. This was on a ridge by City Park.
Metairie Ridge.
Yep, so it didn't flood. It took a little bit of water, but wasn't in bad shape, so it could reopen a lot earlier, even though just a few blocks away, utter apocalypse. Right. So, again, I did a lot of walking in those days because just was absorbing the situation. Just walking from my house in Mid-City to Ralph's in the Park for its opening night, I believe the date was November 9th, 2005. I'm walking. I've got on my fine duds. I've got a hat on because that was the time. And I wore a fedora phase. I'm sorry, people. A jacket because it was November. It was getting a little cool. And as I'm trudging along by Bayou St. John, this truck comes rumbling up. It's one of those dually trucks. And the side of it had a decal, something about, you know, save your souls, some kind of a do-gooder mission out of Texas that had come to feed people. And the window comes down, and the man says, "Brother, do you need a hot meal?" And I looked at him with utter gratitude, and I said, "I'm actually on my way to a dinner reservation." In a few blocks, I'd be eating shrimp remoulade and steak.
That's a great story.
And hoisting a Sazerac.
We got to take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. You know what, Ian, what I wanted to address is that the restaurant industry, it can be fiercely competitive, right? But yet, part of the return was cooperation between restaurants, and I understand it, correct?
Connection ran right through it. It was really, really important.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. We're live from the Presbyter. Newell and Dave Cohen will be here next, then Scoot will be here until 4 o'clock. 19 until 10, time for traffic now on WWL. And Ian McNulty and also Freddie King, councilman for the French Quarter, joins us now. How you doing, Freddie?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Or as you're better known, the defensive end from Archbishop Shaw High School. You guys win a championship or not?
Close, but no cigar.
All right. I saw you at the luncheon. I got a ring, a championship ring. You see the size of that thing?
Huge.
It looks like it gave me carpal tunnel from wearing it. I had to take it off.
Very impressive.
Tell me about the recovery after Katrina, Algiers, and also your district, the French Quarter.
You know, the West Bank, including Algiers, was spared for the most part. Right. I had neighbors who said they didn't lose any power. We were spared.
We were lucky, and Belchase lost the fence.
We had a couple of broken windows, a couple of downed tree limbs. The quarter did okay compared to the rest of the city. I was actually in Hammond in college when it happened. I had 17 family members come move to my apartment, my two-bedroom apartment, for a couple of weeks. And that turned into 2 years. My parents lived right across the street where right across the hallway for me for the next 2 years. So that was experience. That was
Ian
an experience.
McNulty, what do you think about that? Your parents living across from you in your college years.
Your college years.
Oh, I could see. I evacuated to Baton Rouge, and with those early reports we were getting was, you know, New Orleans uninhabitable for a year.
Did
whatever
you play
it was.
Football?
I played football.
Playing football, football player, big stud on campus. He's got his parents living across the street.
Well, people were
across
building.
The open my front door. And my mom opens her front door, and we're looking at each other in the face.
People were building out.
Just the two of you, Freddie, or not?
No, it was my
sister. I mean, looking your mom in the face. Was it just the two of you? Go ahead, Ian, what were you going to say?
No, people in Baton Rouge were building out bunk beds for their family to stay in their dorm rooms at LSU, because that's how bad it was. I mean, people just didn't know.
And a lot of folks forget, we focus on Katrina that happened to us down here, but they had Rita a few weeks later.
Right.
And Lake Charles was hit heavy, and McNeese University is in Lake Charles. So McNeese football team had to move to Southeastern. So we had two college football teams on the same campus using the same cafeteria, the same weight room for the entire semester. So that was it was quite an experience.
So many stories. Thank you, Freddie, for stopping by.
Thank
I know
you
you're busy.
Me.
You got people to see. Ian McNulty, we're talking about the fiercely competitive nature of the restaurant industry, but yet when it came to the recovery, a lot of cooperation, right?
New Orleans is different, right? I hear this all the time, even outside of the Katrina context. You know, people in the restaurant business here in New Orleans, they travel and they talk to people about, oh, we work with these guys, or, you know, we host a dinner with our friends over here at this restaurant. And the jaws drop from restaurateurs in other cities. They just, you're fighting for the same pie. How could you share that pie? And it's just a different attitude.
This wouldn't work in New York or Chicago.
Right, yeah, sure. And so after Katrina, I mean, the chips were down, it really did demonstrate the connection that runs through this community. I mean, you had... First of all, I mean, no po' boy bread, no po' boys, no piece of New Orleans culture right there. So yeah, Leidenheimer bread had to come back, start baking in October. And then the same day, Parasols could start serving its roast beef po' boys again. Guy's po' boys could start up. This continued for years and years. Flash forward 2007, the great Dookie Chase's restaurant. Leah Chase, at the time, she's in her mid-70s. This is 20 years ago. She... was determined to get her restaurant back against all odds on Orleans Avenue there.
If ever Dynamo applied to anybody, it would be Leah Chase.
Exactly right. And this is, I mean, the scope of this thing, the time span, this is 2 years later now. This is 2007. Dookie Chase is preparing to come back. President Bush is preparing to visit for the second anniversary of Katrina, when those anniversaries, not the 20th, just the second, was still like, whoa, is this city going to come back again? It's a big deal that the president is coming here to visit. He wants to eat at Dookie Chase's. It's not quite ready to open. Chef John Fulce steps in, sends down trucks of plates, cooks, supplies, and enables Leah Chase to host President Bush at her restaurant. And that showed, again, to the world 2 years later, look, these restaurants are coming back. New Orleans is coming back. The streets are no longer flooded, which was a long-running misconception because of old news clips that would circulate. And it happened again and again when Commander's Palace finally came back. I mean, some of these restaurants, we talk about the ones that could come back early, they were relatively unscathed. Others that were so severely damaged or caught in the tangle of insurance and whatever it was they were dealing with, I mean, it took years for them to come back. And it was a really, really moving time, Tommy, every time one of them did through those years. You know, we have restaurants in this city that are 100 years old, and people got to be there for the return, the debut of a 101-year-old restaurant. Galatoire's turned 100 in 2005, earlier that spring. There was a big party on Bourbon Street. We didn't know it was coming, obviously. And then it reopened in December of the same year. It was a bigger celebration that they're reopening. Same thing with Angelo Brocato's, the great ice cream parlor in Mid-City. Turned 100 in 2005 early in the year, turned 101 to reopen a year later. Amazing experience.
We only have a minute left, but I do want to acknowledge maybe some restaurants that did not survive.
So many, and I have a story on NOLA.com actually where you can relive it in some of our great archival pictures, but Restaurant Manditch on St. Claude Avenue, the Galatoire's of the Night Ward, they called it, Brunning's, of course, in the lakefront, Sid Mars, which did come back for a time inland, but... was never really the same after that. I mean, there's a pumping station where Sid Mars used to be. Barrow's Shady Inn, that amazing catfish. La Riviera, you know, Goffredo's restaurant in Metairie.
What was the split appetizer? Crab meat, ravioli, and Mozzarella crawfish fettuccine?
Oh, that's it. Yeah. Yes, that's it. That's it. A Bella Luna, the great restaurant on in the French Market overlooking the river, which you can get their fettuccine at Middendorf's. The chef still serves it in September at his – he took over Middendorf's restaurant in Manchac. You can still get a taste of Bella Luna up there.
He's
amazing.
Done a great job.
Yes.
He really has.
Great connections running all through our hospitality world, Tommy.
Ian McNulty,
glad
never enough time.
Yep.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again next Friday.
Thank you, New Orleans. Thank you, everyone who came back and everybody who moved here afterwards to contribute to this community and become part of it. I never for a second will forget those moments of feeling that New Orleans truly would be back, and everyone who's here now made it possible.
Amen. Thank you, Father McNulty. We'll take a break. We're live here at the Presbyterian in Jackson Square, WWO, continuing our week-long remembrance of Katrina. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWO.
Your true crime podcast keeps listeners on the edge of their seats. But here's the real mystery. Why isn't it making more money? Odyssey Creator Lab is here to solve that. We host your show for free. No fees, no catch. You focus on the suspense while our sales team brings in advertisers and revenue. Stop leaving money on the table. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and turn your passion for true crime into real revenue.